President Maduro has said the real reason for Trump's fixation on Venezuela is oil. What do you think about that?
Yes, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says the real motive behind the massive U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean Sea is all about oil. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, even larger than Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. State Department denies this. The U.S. State Department insists that the airstrikes on boats that have killed more than 80 people, this is part of a campaign against drug trafficking. But what has now become clear, certainly in the past few weeks, is that Donald Trump is absolutely determined on regime change in Venezuela. I mean, the size of the military forces in the Caribbean Sea suggests very much regime change. And we can say that Trump has proved happy to reach an understanding with authoritarian leaders elsewhere, for example. And we can also say that these airstrikes on various boats and vessels in the Caribbean Sea, these are unlikely to have much impact on the flow of drugs in the United States. In fact, most experts say that the majority of those drugs flow into the United States by land through the vast southern border with Mexico. So critics are saying that these airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea, allegedly drug boats, they won't have much effect in sort of restricting the supply of drugs into the United States, because most of the drugs are coming through land through the border with Mexico.
That's right.
Now, what about Colombia? Well, Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, who is himself is involved in a bitter feud with Donald Trump, he has described the last campaign in the last 3 or 4 months against Caracas as a negotiation about oil. So again, Colombia's president, a next-door neighbor to Venezuela, he thinks that much of what is going on in the Caribbean Sea and all this pressure on Nicolas Maduro is a sort of a negotiation about oil. And Colombian President Gustavo Petro said Trump is not thinking about democratizing Venezuela, much less about drug trafficking. He's simply interested in the oil.
Right. Russian President Vladimir Putin has expressed his solidarity with the Venezuelan people. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the Kremlin said in a statement that Vladimir Putin spoke with Nicolas Maduro by phone and reaffirmed his support to the Venezuelan leader. President Putin said Maduro's policy of protecting national interests and sovereignty in the face of growing external pressure, he said, Russia backs Venezuela. And this phone call actually happened after U.S. military forces seized that oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. So the phone conversation took place after the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military. President Maduro has insisted the real purpose of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean Sea near Venezuela is really to do with Venezuela's oil. As far as the oil tanker is concerned, the Venezuelan government has said the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy. The Venezuelan government has added President Putin told President Maduro that direct communication between Moscow and Caracas would remain permanently open, and Russia would continue to support Venezuela in its struggle to assert its sovereignty, international law, and peace throughout Latin America. Now, I can say that just like his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro has forged a close relationship with Russia. And another thing I can mention is that back in 2018, there was a brief period when Russia dispatched a pair of Tu Tupolev 160 bombers to an airport just outside Venezuela's capital, Caracas. And this was back in 2018. So the Russians have given military support to Venezuela in the past as well.
Right. To sum up it briefly then, the seizure of the oil tanker near Venezuela's coastline is literally theft in broad daylight, and Trump's claim that he wants to keep the oil shows that a major motivation for attacking is to take control of Venezuela's oil. Thank you, Mr. Grashina, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return. To know you, I've learned so much.
Been a pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Remember me, so I might be with you. I'm a traveler, just as they were,
walking the world,
thinking of the past on an earth so vast,
waiting to return, waiting to return, waiting to return, return to my
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine.
This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration.
The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them. Even during last Christmas, I remember how churches were bombed into rubbles.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine.
And their policies are neo-fascist. They talk about annihilating all the Palestinians, the women, the children, everybody. There's no reservation about it. And Netanyahu follows this, partly because he's ideologically inclined.
With churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus and hundreds of thousands of people murdered, it will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids, to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old, okay? I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office, okay? Other countries through mass protests like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up in nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low, and down from 40% as recently as March.
Because a lot of people don't believe in politics, don't address it, don't see it, but they do see what's happening in the pocketbook, in their own reality. And that's the first thing that people address, Americans address.
Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars.
Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
For many Syrians, Israel's latest remarks reinforce a belief that the threat extends far beyond Syria's borders. The statement is widely viewed as an open declaration of hostility toward the region, rather than mere political rhetoric.
This entity threatens the entire Arab world, not just Syria or Palestine. We aren't afraid, but there must be a broader popular response, especially by Arabs. Sadly, people's reactions remain slow, while some governments align with Israel.
Syrians also connect these statements to recent Israeli incursions in the south, including the attack on ByteGen. Many view these events as early indicators of a dangerous shift that may eventually demand decisive action.
This regime won't stop at Palestine. It wants full control of the region in order to control all the resources of its people. It has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
This year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Nad Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah City, Palestine.
Again, 120 people were murdered in a massacre by the RSF militia as they attacked a kindergarten, a village, and a hospital. Most of the dead were children aged 3, 4, and 5. The massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also we know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
The UAE are supporter of the RSF rebels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to address, which is called only about foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the sixth such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of 8 World Food Programme workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza. Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pakistan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen the very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relation with other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be a important mediator as compared to the other one. Being in, as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a state, a stakeholder, also having projects with India, being a state. Because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Asia. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General Raffaele Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate, and the agency, Atomic International Atomic Agency, is one of our key partners because, as you might know, we've created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the decision to build a new nuclear power plant till the finishing of its and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been relying, and we were looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we were very helpful for them, for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it, you are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more, such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural, I think. As soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant, modern technology, the highest level of security. You know, for Belarus, we are very vulnerable in that sense because we've had a tragedy in 1986 in Chernobyl, and Belarus was severely contaminated by the radiation after that. So for some years, we had to persuade people that peaceful and very modern and very secure atomic energy can bring substantial results for the economy. As I mentioned, the energy consumption is growing each and every year. People, the regular citizens, they buy more and more electric cars, more and more public transportation means is driven by the electricity. We started developing the mining capacities for cryptocurrency, and we're looking for the data center creation. Belarus is a developed IT country that puts a lot of attention to that sector. Well, that's why we see the trend and we follow it just.
You mentioned the constructive cooperation with the IAEA in regards to peaceful nuclear energy, but at the same time, we have witnessed, in particular the last 2 years, heated debates here in this building, here in Vienna, at the Board of Governors meetings, at the General Conference of the IAEA, in relation to ongoing armed conflicts around the world, both in Middle East, West Asia, and in Eastern Europe. Two of your neighboring countries, Russia and Ukraine, are at war at the moment. And there is debate on security of nuclear plants in Ukraine, also in the Kursk region. There are regular attacks in the vicinity of these nuclear plants. How do you see the role of the IAEA in these conflicts?
IAEA has the highest ever reputation in that sphere, and represents a big majority of countries that have the atomic capacities on their territory, and they know that security in that sphere is crucial. So in the ongoing conflict, I think, and you've heard that on the conference, President suggested that we should introduce a ban for the attacks on critical infrastructure objects, and we should protect them properly, and we should mobilize the support of the international community, meaning the protection. I meant also the ban for imposing sanctions on the industries, countries that utilize the atomic energy, because that might bring to some shortages of spare parts or some technologies that are crucially sufficient and necessary for providing the security. So definitely those capacities, atomic capacities, should be duly protected, and because the explosion on them could easily bring to the situation that we've had on the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and in any other countries. And this could contaminate vast territories, big territories in Europe. So for our own security, we should do a lot and persuade the international community, and the International Atomic Agency could do a good job in that, persuading their members to refrain from attacking the NPPs.
Which is actually the statute of the IAEA, but still in June, such attacks happened. The US and Israel attacked Iranian sites, nuclear sites. In reaction to that, unfortunately, Director General Grossi refused to condemn these attacks. And at the General Conference in September, a resolution had been tabled by Russia, China, and Iran, and also supported by your country, Belarus, to refrain from these attacks. How do you see the situation now that even in the 21st century, it is still necessary to table a motion that says we are against attacks on peaceful nuclear facilities?
I think that we are still a little bit far from getting the long-standing solution for that, but I can only confirm that Belarus will support each and every effort that will bring more protection, more security, and more peace, even if there are some dispute or conflict appears. We were following attentively, I think many people, many politicians in our region and outside were worried about the situation which took place in Iran, and I think that exactly not by weapons, not by means of military forces, any obstacles, any disputes could be solved. This is the job of the international employees, international agencies, politicians and diplomats, and that's what we are interested to do. We do believe in a classical diplomacy without fakes, without assaults, attacks on each other. That's what we see now on the OEC premises in the United Nations. People sometimes blame secretariats of these organizations for not providing a proper assistance or just infrastructure or getting some events which would suit them. But, you know, I would like to draw your attention that the secretariats, they just serve the countries. And the atmosphere which is now in Vienna, in Geneva, in New York, and in other European and world capitals is just like this, like the countries are representing themselves on these sides. So we have to start, and we've talked about that with Director General of the Atomic Agency, that we do believe that politicians from countries active in that sphere, in the sphere of security, in atomic energy, in the conflict settlement, they will be more polite and they will be more constructive in discussing modern challenges.
And you just mentioned the OSCE, that was, so to say, the second purpose of your visit to Vienna, the 32nd Ministry Conference of the OSCE that took place here in Vienna this week. And I followed the conference very closely. I listened to the speeches over the past 2 days, and listening to the speeches, the constant attacks both on Belarus and Russia from every single minister, delegate and representative. One might wonder, why are you attending the OSCE conference in such an atmosphere?
Because we do believe in the spirit of Helsinki. We believe in the force of real classical diplomacy. We do believe in the future of this organization, which can be a very effective instrument in for the conflict settlement. That's what it has been designed for. You're absolutely right. What we see in Holbrook recent years is just the throwing to each other the national statements. But unlike many other countries from Europe and other regions, we each and every time try to persuade our partners, try to find the solutions, try to mobilize the support, try to find the not politically biased topics that we could discuss in smaller groups, in a some formats that are not non-discriminatory for other participants. And I think what we are now lacking at the OSCE premises is the talks about the participation of Russia and security for Russia. Because what has started in Ukraine, it was the lack of security for Russia itself, with the NATO expansion, with the collapse of Soviet Union, with the collapse of the international architecture, with the collapse of the spirit of Helsinki that brought people from different countries with different views to the same table, which finalized with the final act, Helsinki Final Act in 1975. So I do believe in the power and force of diplomacy, and I hope we will shortly bring to an end to that conflict, and we will restore the trust and enhance the confidence building measures.
But as I said, listening to the speech and also following other international organizations, one becomes very pessimistic that this approach is even possible. Instead of what you said, the spirit of Helsinki in 1975, the idea of closing the gap between different blocs, presenting a space for dialogue. Now we see a clear split in all international organizations, the introductions of sanctions against states, just like your state, but also other states, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and the so-called sanctions regime from the West is tightening. How you assess, in general, the Eurasian security architecture at the moment?
Well, I think that we should bring the security issues in a broader context than Europe itself. We should expand it to the whole continent, Eurasian continent, and that's what we are doing regularly in Minsk since already 3 years. The newest edition of the conference took place in October, end of October in Minsk, and every year it gets with more and more participants. We enhance the level of political participants from different countries, and we try to attract as many attention as we can, transforming this event to the unlike-minded event. We are not seeking support and looking only for our friends. We are also inviting those who will not support us, but they will understand our motivation, our efforts, and will someday they will bring some also support and income to the to that format. I do agree with you that the situation is far from ideal, from being too peaceful. But if we stop talking, if we close the doors, we will bring the world and the region to the war, the global war, or to the full-scale war in the region. That's what we don't want to do. And our intention is not to make everyone agree with us. The intention was to make everyone understand what we mean, and we could also understand the intentions of the other side. That brings, because the war is being often starts when people don't talk to each other and they don't understand each other. This misunderstanding it enhances the level of conflict potential. Conference is a good format. You participated in that, and I think you felt the atmosphere of Minsk spirit, so to say. And we will continue. We are not substituting OSCE in any case. OSCE is an international organization where we could do the three traditional baskets, our cooperation, and the conference is the awareness building, is the spreading of information, and gaining support from countries that are worried by the problems in Eurasian security. Well, we've seen the number of participants from big Eurasia, from different countries, from different analytics reviewers and specialists in international relations. I like this atmosphere we've created, and I do believe that we will go further, because it has become an annual event.
By strengthening Eurasian security at the same time, when you look at the Western media, the Western politicians, they accuse Belarus of undermining European security. Very often you hear this example of using migrants to undermine Western European security. What do you say to this argument?
Well, we don't use anyone. Migrants are trying to cross the border illegally via our territory, because they are desperate about the situation in their countries, of origin, and they use our territory to get to a better life. But what they see on the border, they see the cruel pushbacks, they see the unwelcome approach from the authorities of the neighboring countries. They don't see any even procedures, refugees procedures or asylum seekers procedures. They don't see the, and they, are being disappointed, and we see less and less those poor people on our borders. We try to persuade our partners that we should return to the format of building shelters for those people. We should do something to improve situations in their countries of origin, and Belarus is very much engaged in that process. You've noticed probably visits of our president, of our prime minister, of our minister of foreign affairs to Asian countries, to African countries, where we create jobs, where we supply our technologies and equipment, and that brings more trust, more confidence, and we are happy that our turnover is increasing in food and products and machinery and so on. So I think that the illegal migration is a problem that we could combat only together. Throwing the claims on some countries, that doesn't help to change the situation for the best. So we call upon international community and our neighbors and countries of origin of those migrants to sit and see together what could be done to improve the situation. Commenting your remarks on the Eurasian security, I would like to know that the main problem mostly lays that some parties want to win, but we all win if the war will not start. That will be the win. We should not collapse or bring the some countries to collapse as they did with the Soviet Union. On the political map of Europe, each and every country today presents a guarantee that something bad will not happen, that the military conflict will not break out. You see what happened in Ukraine. That's because of lack of confidence and lack of security granted for all countries. You cannot be secured if you bring insecurity to your neighbors. So the neighborhood, we consider the neighborhood is the main asset that we have to share and we have to preserve with all our neighbors. And I mentioned that numerously on the OEC premises. We don't want to see the NATO at our borders. We want to see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. As in the sense of neighborhood, it's vital for us.
At the same time, you mentioned avoiding a war. The world is moving into a new direction towards a multipolar world. The North American domination is clearly coming to an end, but particularly the European Union is unwilling to accept it. We recently see the introduction of the Rearm Europe program, conscription in France, in Germany, building massive armies. They even talk about we need to go to war against Russia. How can a war actually be avoided?
Well, the war could be avoided with the perception that it will bring no victory to some separate countries. This will bring blood, victims, destructive infrastructure. Unfortunately, those who rearm their armies and enhance the level of militarization, they have forgotten about the pain and tragedy that war has brought to their countries. And I think that I do believe that we don't need a new war to understand that, because war is very expensive, very unpredictable, and it will economically it's not efficient means of solving the problems. The only efficient way, maybe longer than the military conflict, but longer but very stable and will bring more profit when we sit and again discuss things instead of militarize, put money, pump money into the military budgets and enhance the military industry and enhance the army, because it's not economically necessary, and it will bring the traditional spheres of the economy to a collapse.
But at the same time, we see increasingly a move of some states to work outside the international law framework. United States, Israel, with their attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, breaking international law, and these attacks have no consequences for these countries, no consequences at the UN Security Council. How can international rule-based order re-established?
You know, the architecture, international architecture, and the rule of law has been not destroyed, but in a bad shape at the moment. I agree with you. How could we restore that? By restoring confidence, by restoring trust, by showing each other that we respect international law, which has been created by many generations before us. And we should create new mechanisms that will help to build, rebuild it, that and restore that trust and confidence. I do agree with you that the secretariats of international organization, often monopolized by certain countries' representatives, that don't want to talk about any appeasement, any peaceful solution on different matters. And what the Security Council, as I mentioned, reflects the current state of the intergovernmental relations. So sooner or later, I believe in the force of diplomacy, we will sit and decide that, because many countries that are trying to support military operation in Ukraine, they realize that their communities are lacking something very substantial, social standards, the energy tariffs, the cost of living is not as it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that the policymakers should realize that they are specifically designed and brought to their positions not to start the wars, but to finish and end up the conflicts and to settle problems and make their best to enhance the standard of living for their population, for their communities. People are against the war, that's evident, but on the West, they are frightened, they are scared by every day's reports, information reports, saying that one country is an aggressor, somebody there is their supporters, and so on. But, you know, this is the today's everyday's routine, unfortunately. But I do believe that the glass is more than half full than empty. So we are doing, you know, with our colleagues, a lot of job at the moment to find right formats and right solutions in the sphere of international relations in our region. And the topic number one on my desk every day is the security issues, situation on the border, and relations with the neighbors.
And final question, coming back to the Third Eurasian Security Conference in Minsk, really high-profile conference. If you look at the participants, contrary to the OSCE meeting here in Vienna at the moment, we saw a personal participation of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We saw high-profile representation from many other countries like China, Hungary, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. But I'm wondering how this conference and the debate and discussions at this conference can be turned into practice to strengthen Eurasian security.
It's already been transferred into a practice, because as a follow-up, we see the numerous consultations between the ministries, we see the interaction of analytical community, we continue the meetings in a smaller formats of representatives that were part of our conference. We see the articles and we see the effects in, you know, more predictable and friendly relations between countries participating on that conference. We see new perspectives for the trade turnover and economic relations. I think that the money spent to organize that conference, we've saved a lot of resources due to that event. More and more people do believe what they saw with their own eyes and do not believe in what they read or hear every day from TV or from internet. They see how country looks like, they see how people are living, and that even enhances the diplomatic efforts that we maintain every day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deputy Foreign Minister Igor Segreta. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us from the UN headquarters, the Vienna International Center, here on Face to Face, and goodbye for now.
That love strikes only once, that precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? You are my guiding light that walks me through the Everything I possess, I offer you. I wanna be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining?
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lofty levels of humanity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shredi with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, so lofty levels of humanity. So this, in a sense, is sort of goal setting. We know as Muslims that we can really aspire to, and we can reach very high levels of humanity if we purify ourselves, if we have good akhlaq, if we are